16 inches. I've ground in my life, I've ground a 4-inch, an 8-inch, which I actually still have in the basement, and a 16-inch.
Yeah, Mr. John Groot is the guy who is the most prominent member, in my opinion, of Astronomical Society of Long Island. And he ground himself a pair, count them two, 31-inch diameter mirrors. The first one broke and had to be done again. And yes, you stand on a great big A-frame ladder to look through the eyepiece of his Newtonian scope, which I think is a Dobson mount. In other words, the heavy end is mounted on the ground with a pivoting mechanism. And boy, that is one hell of a telescope. But that's a real labor of love to grind a mirror accurately that big. I know we're getting a little bit off subject here, Mel, but astronomy for a guy with a scientific interest is a real great hobby. As I said, I think it's the most purest science in the world, and it asks some really deep questions as to how do all this stuff get here and are we alone. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, you made a good comment there because you did make some recommendations on, who suggests that we use, as Eric said, a projection, you know, use the scope and then project it onto a white sheet of paper. You're looking at the sun, and that type of safety is much more safe way of going. I have a, in fact, I tried this tonight again. I was able, with that Polaris telescope, clearly see the moon of Jupiter. I tried the binoculars. I have a pair of binoculars here that are 7x50 field, 7.1 degrees. I cannot see the moons of Jupiter, nor can I see the, when I look at Saturn, the rings of Saturn, but I can see with the telescope. So does that mean that you got to have at least much more, how much more power would you say? Because I know with the telescope using the 25 millimeter lens, I can see the moons of Jupiter and the rings of Saturn, over.
Okay, if a person goes to the astronomy forum that's held every year in Rockland Community College, roughly the month of April or May, there you're going to see more than 100 vendors selling all kinds of astronomy things. And one of the beautiful things that they sell there every year, and I bought one there last year, is this metallic object, not made out of plastic, metallic object that screws into the front of a pair of binoculars. And that metallic object gives you a huge amount of steadiness of your binoculars when you mount it on a good tripod. Handheld binoculars, even if you block yourself up against the side of a building, and you're holding your binoculars as steady as you can against the side of the building, and as steady as you can, and you're holding your breath, you won't come within a 10-to-1 ratio of what those binoculars will show you if you really mount them with a steady mount, something that screws into the front end of the pivot mechanism of the binoculars, and then screws down to with a 1/4-20 thread on a real good tripod. You look through that binoculars with a real good tripod, you will definitely see the moons of Jupiter. The Galileo's first telescope was a really yucky piece of glass, very poorly grounded. It was it had chromatic aberration, it had spherical aberration, it had coma aberration, had very low power, but he saw those moons of Jupiter. With your binoculars, you will, with your 7x50, by the way, 7 means 7-to-1 magnification, 50 means the millimeters of the diameter. That's a good set of binoculars. As long as they're properly, let me drop you. As long as they're properly collimated, and again, when you get them properly mounted with a metallic object onto a tripod, and you aim them at a bright star, and then put the bright star in the middle of the binoculars, and then you back away from the binoculars very carefully so that both eyes are looking through the two separate sides of the binoculars. And if you can back away, let me pick a number, 1 foot, and if the image that you see in the left eye and the image that you see in the right eye are congruent, if both of them show the star on top of each other, then you have a properly set of collimated binoculars. And if you read the right book to recollimate your binoculars because somebody has dropped them, and sold them very cheaply at a flea market, and they're now out of collimation, which means the left-hand one is looking up and the right-hand one is looking down and to the right, if you know what I mean, the two sides of the binocular. You don't get anywhere near as much resolution, and when you study real hard and you force the image to look right in your brain through that uncollimated set of binoculars, and you look through that for 2 minutes, and then you take the binoculars away and you try to walk, and your eyes have to readjust, and the brain's got to readjust. If you're into one of those situations, you know you've got some very non-collimated binoculars. Properly mounted, those binoculars of yours will do a lot more magic than you have ever seen, Mel. K2KEY, this is a well-kept secret. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, this is K2KEY. Well, I realized that a long time ago, that I could never hold them steady enough, I could say, to look at stars. So I do. I have a tripod with that mount that locks the binoculars in place. And no, I've been scared a couple times. This 7x50 binoculars just can't see. I couldn't see the rings of Saturn, and I couldn't see the moons of Jupiter again. Tried it tonight again. Set it up and said, see, let me give it one more try. Binoculars have never been thrown around. It was my personal binoculars purchase, brand new. In fact, I even had a coupon when I purchased it that you could, after using them for like 3 years or something, you send them back and they clean it for you and check them out and all that. So I took advantage of that. But the binoculars, they stay in their case. They're in nice case and everything. So they just don't see it. That's it. But that with that telescope with the 25 millimeter lens in there, oh, there was the Jupiter is really clear tonight, and the moons and everything. And I've had a lot of fun with that. In fact, I took it out really to show the kids next door. He asked me, and I said, come, I'll show you what it looks like. And he was really quite amazed also. Mostly young people do get, you know, very excited about astronomy. Okay. With that, maybe we should go over to our space report. Getting late, Dick. Over.
Query. Go ahead, Alan. It's Dave, APG. You'd be amazed how, with one word, you'd be amazed how your voice sounds like Alan. You got it, Dave. Okay, sent to APG. It's just a quick query from Mel. I know he's pretty technical, and I think he probably knows how to focus his binocular, you know, to take advantage of the ocular adjustment on both eyes. Is he doing that properly? I'm pretty sure he is, and now that I think about it a little bit more, the smallest telescope I've got where I can easily see Jupiter is my so-called spotting scope, which is I think it's around a 2.5-inch diameter. That's the one that you had in your hands of mine, Dave. And I think it zooms from something like 12 to 25. And with that, I can easily see the moons of Jupiter. The more I think about it, have I seen the moons of Jupiter on a 7-power set of binoculars? The answer might be no. And with a little bit of research, we can find out what is the angular separation of the moons of Jupiter from Jupiter. A little bit of search, we can find that out. We can easily then calculate whether or not a 7-to-1 power binoculars can do it with a normal set of eyes that are approaching 70 years of age. You had a comment on that one, Dave?
Yeah, I see them all the time with 7x50s and stuff. Mind you, it's going to be small, and the moons are tiny. But, you know, if they're clean and they're collimated and you focus very carefully, you can easily see them.
Comment?
Yeah, there's a problem on that, though. You're looking with a 35-year set of eyes, Dave, and Mel and I are looking with a 70-year-old set of eyes. John, go ahead.
AC2WGV. Yes, Mel, also remember, with the binoculars, you need a longer period of eye rest in darkness so that they will function as efficiently as they do with the telescope. That's something you may want to try next time.
Yeah, you're going from photopic vision to scotopic vision. It takes 20 solid minutes in a dark environment for a human eye to come up to full sensitivity, dark adapted eye, at least 20 minutes. And for people of our age, Mel, it probably takes us 30 minutes. So were you in the darkness for 30 solid minutes with a well-collimated set of binoculars on a good steady tripod, with good focus, left eye and right eye, good differential focus, good common focus, good collimation. And maybe you ought to take a volunteer from your neighborhood with a younger set of eyes and also have them look through the binoculars. K2KEY, KQRIW in the TechNet.
By the way, Dick, it's 40 minutes now.
I'll take your word for it, depending on the level of dock adaptation you want. You got it, Mel.
No doubt. You had to tell everybody that we're 70 years old, of course, Dick. Yeah, you're right, Dick. No, what I did, of course, with the binoculars, I even tried to use it as a binocular, you know, one at a time. Like I would look through the telescope one at a time, and I tried it. I just don't see the moons of Jupiter tonight. I didn't, and it's clear. It was beautiful through the E telescope with just even the 25-millimeter lens in there. With the binocular, I tried every which way, and I just don't see it. As far as, no, I wasn't out in the dark for 40 minutes, but like I say, with the telescope, I saw it instantly, over.
If you have the latest issue, or the correct issue, of Sky and Telescope magazine, every hour of every day, they will show you exactly where the location of the so-called Galilean moons, the four major moons of Jupiter, Ganymede, Callisto. If I'm not in duress, I can come up with the four names right away. Depending on where those moons are, Mel, Murphy's Law could dictate that the... Say again?
Io and Europa.
Io, Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto. You got it. I enjoy great cars. This is the letter abbreviation. Anyhow, you look at the right issue of Sky and Telescope magazine. I'm sure there are some websites also. The possibility exists that all of Jupiter's moons were behind the planet or so closely packed to the planet at that hour that you looked that there was nothing to see. There's a slim possibility of that, Mel. So don't give up. Anybody have any further comments on that? K2RIW in the second minute.
But it has to be strung out nice and neat tonight, Dick. Nice and spacey. Beautiful tonight. And I can say, with the telescope, it was really nice sighting, over.
Okay. You've closed the door on that theory. The fact that you saw them strung out very nicely with your telescope. I suspect that since Dave, through his 7-power binoculars, can definitely see the moons of Jupiter, with a young enough set of eyes, it is possible. And another comment. Go ahead, Dave. You got it, Dave.
Yeah, there's no question about it. 7x50, it's, you know, you can see the moons, but it's not that easy. Like Mel was saying, no problem with the telescope. He saw the moons quite clearly. Mel, if you want to have some fun, spend a little bit of money. For about $100, you can pick up a pair of what I would recommend is either a 12x60 or a 15x70 binocular. They're made in China. They're about $100. You get them on eBay, but you can have a lot of fun with them, and the quality of them is actually pretty good.
Yeah, I've done that. I own either 15x70 or 16x70, something like that, and they're useless without a tripod. On a tripod, wow, can you see things with those things, astronomically speaking. And with my 8-inch diameter telescope, something that's very non-common sense is that you can buy an eyepiece that takes your one ocular output from this 8-inch diameter telescope, splits it with prisms into two separate images that then goes through two separate eyepieces. It's a binocular viewer for a normal monocular telescope. So now you're seeing that image with two eyes, and yes, you're cutting down half the light and sending half the light to each eye. Therefore, the light gets dimmer, and common sense would believe you're going to have less resolution. Something about binocular vision and the way a human brain works, that binocular vision properly set up does allow you to see things you wouldn't ordinarily see. That's real fun. There was another person who wanted to make a comment. I'm not sure, but it could have been Doug. KQRIW listening?
Dad, I want to answer that question, Dick. I'll tell you a funny thing about it.
Okay, good, Eric. Yeah, Eric and Mel recognized, but I think there was another person two transmissions back. Was that you, Doug? Go ahead.
Amateur one. I would like to know, what is the very bright star that you see roughly due south at about 60 degrees above the horizon just about now?
That is Jupiter. That's the first thing that Galileo looked at, and boy, we haven't heard the end of that one. Over to you, Doug. Did you hear what I said, Doug? Okay, Eric next, KE2EJ, go ahead.
Yeah, just if you want to take a quick check of your binoculars, if you look at the North Star, and you'll discover that it's actually made up of two stars. Also, if you look at the Big Dipper, the two stars that are pointing at the end, they actually point towards the North Star, and you should be able to resolve two stars very easily with a good set of binoculars.
Yeah, but if you get the New York Times and you look at the Sunday issue, the back of the sports section, and you see that diagram of the sky right now, you realize that the majority of the Big Dipper is out of sight. So, yes, the North Star is always visible. The Big Dipper that points to the North Star is essentially invisible at this time. There was another person who wanted to make a comment. Who was that?
KE1.
You got it, Mel.
Okay. The reason I bought these binoculars, the 7x50, I go down here, a couple hundred feet to my south, and, you know, I'm right by the ocean, and so I be able to stand there and look at boats and look across to New Jersey, to Sandy Hook, and everything. You know, a lot of nice viewing, a lot of things, people fishing and this thing and that. Enjoy it. Sometimes they have the races there, the boat races, the sailboat races, things of that sort. That's what I really got those binoculars for. Worked great. If I take the telescope and I look across, like New Jersey, I put the telescope down there, and even with a 25-millimeter lens, for some reason, you see like a, how do I say it, like a haze, like a bio, something coming off the magnifying some kind of a radiation. Like across the bay, Dick. That really shows up with the binoculars, over.
When you run any optical sensing device, bigger and bigger telescopes, and you run it parallel to the Earth's surface, you'll see all kinds of things you don't ordinarily see. Perturbations of the air and whatever. So that's normal, Mel. And yes, you are seeing the haze of the water vapor evaporating off of the sea. One of the best views I've ever had when I was out at Horton's Point, at the lighthouse at Horton's Point on the North Fork of Long Island, about 4 or 5 years ago, on a super clear day. And I looked to the west toward Port Jefferson. From the top of that lighthouse, which is only about 60 or so feet, maybe 80 feet off of the ground, I easily saw the water showing me the Earth curvature as I was looking toward Port Jefferson. It gave me a very funny feeling. It was such a super clear day. So it's a lot of fun to use high-power optical devices. With my optical telescope, my 8-inch telescope, looking through thermal pane, double glass, non-optical glass, really yucky glass, so to speak, optically speaking, on the front of my living room. Let me drop. I was looking, my house is mounted, I guess, over 100 feet from the road. The road itself is probably 80 feet wide. Then another 100 feet across the neighbor's property, across the street. And somebody had stuck a business card into his door, because they knocked on his door, and no one answered. And I was just running an experiment one day. And I started putting higher and higher power lenses on my 8-inch telescope. So I'm a total of 200 and some odd feet away, and I'm reading the fine print on this business card that's stuck into the door. And some of the fine print, now while I walked up there with my ruler and held it against the fine print, and I think the fine print was in the vicinity of a 16th of an inch high. and I'm reading that from 200 and some odd feet away, but there's a catch. It had to be 20 seconds or more after a car passed. If a car passed on that road, it stirred up the air, and if the air didn't settle down on this very calm, clear day for another 20 or so seconds, where the image would finally settle down and I could read that card. It's kind of amazing what kind of resolution you can get with modern optical devices. I was just doing that as an experiment, if you know what I mean. And with any further comments or questions, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2MDP.
Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, Dick, that one station, that star he was mentioning, that is due south, I guess. Yeah, it's probably around 60 degrees, maybe a little less. It's funny because I was looking at that same thing last night and I wondered what it is. It is a star. It's I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it correct. It's Fomalhaut. I got the spelling here. Let's see. Fomalhaut. And I guess the magnitude, that would be the brightness of it. And magnitude, it says, is 1.16. Back to you, Dick.
Let me ask you this, Steve. Are you familiar enough with the sky that you would definitely know the difference between a star and the planet Jupiter, which is roughly the same direction at this time? Over to you, Steve.
No, Dick, I am not that knowledgeable of the sky. That's why I have this little thing. I have one of these little, like the iPhone. It's actually an iPod Touch, and I have an app that's pretty cool. And if you give me a second here, I'll go back. And I'll tell you exactly what this app is. It is called P-Universe. And you can download it on the iPhone application, which is nice. It's a nice little portable thing, and you just, aim it the direction you're looking at, and it shows you all the stars, planets, everything like that. Back to you.
Does that application know that Steve is looking at the sky on October 10th of 2010, does it know the date? Does it know the hour? And does it know where Jupiter is? Will it show you where Jupiter is? Can you see the difference between
There's also an app called Planets that knows exactly where you are when you are.
Okay. Will that application you're using, Steve, show you where Jupiter is? And is there a difference between Jupiter and that star that you're mentioning?
Most certainly, Dick. Yes, I did look. I did look to see where Jupiter was, and according to this thing, at least last night, Jupiter was a little bit more east. It was more southeast. Yeah, this thing is pretty nice. It knows exactly where you are. It knows the time. It knows the date. It knows everything. You could speed it up several minutes, several hours. You could speed this thing up several days, even several years. You can go back and forward in time to know where everything is. You can. It's got a little thing there that'll point out the planets. It'll point out the constellations. It's a pretty cool little thing, and it's actually free on the Apple App Store there. Back to you.
Question, Dick? Jupiter Day, WS2M.
Yeah. Steve, did you see Jupiter, and then did you see something that is about 3 magnitudes dimmer, which is that star? Did you first see Jupiter, and then did you see that dimmer star? Over to you, Steve.
No, actually, Dick, I thought that was Jupiter, I didn't have my telescope out. I really haven't used it in quite a while, but I am into it. And I said, oh, that looks like Jupiter. Let me look on my little thing here and see exactly what it is. And sure enough, standing out there, from the constellations and stuff, you let your eyes adjust. And it was this star. Back to you.
Okay. John, I think, is the next person. Go ahead, John.
Dick, that bright object is pretty, it's right on the ecliptic. Is the star he's talking about on the ecliptic also?
Okay, I've asked the question 2 or 3 times, and I'm not sure what Steve's answer is, whether or not he first saw the brightest object, which is Jupiter, then did he see something about 3 magnitudes weaker, which is that star, Fomalhaut, I think it is. Steve, do you believe you first saw Jupiter, then you saw this thing that's a lot dimmer, but still very bright by way of stars go? Over to you, Steve.
No, Dick, I did not see Jupiter, but I did look it up, on this on this little thing here for the iPod. And actually, it seemed like Jupiter was dimmer. Maybe it was just me, but you know, all indications pointed that it was this star Fraumelhaus. Back to you.
Jupiter, Dick, I just want to add that WS2N.
There is no doubt about it, unless there was an extremely specific cloud in front of Jupiter. Jupiter is tremendously brighter than any other star. So what you thought was Jupiter, and you said it was dimmer, I'm beginning to think something is reversed here, Steve. Go ahead.
Yeah, funny you should mention that, Dick. I'm looking it up. I'm trying to, you know, find Jupiter on my little thing, and I will actually go outside and try and, you know, figure it out. Back to you.
Dick, Jupiter right now is between Pisces, Aquarius, and Cetus.
Yeah, for a person who's not completely familiar with the constellations, for a guy like you, that helps a lot, Eric. But for us normal mortals, that may not do it. I think it's time for a space report. Paul, WS2N, and you've been looking at the stars. Tell me what you saw tonight. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, WS2N. I just went outside. I've seen that for so many years. I get tired of looking at it, but yeah, that's along the ecliptic, and that's how you can tell. You know, all your planets travel along the ecliptic. You know, now you just got to remember where the sun and the moon crossed. You know, you pass from the horizon to horizon during that time of year. Just you know, different times of year it's at a lower. You might have a lower angle or a higher angle. If you remember, well, the sun went along that path during the day. If I look up that same location tonight, I'm about to find some planets. Chances are you have a good shot. As far as the space report, let me drop it. I really had a question tonight, so we'll go with that. And, oh, yeah, okay, on people interested in Hubble, and also an interest in another big story was when Pluto was demoted, and a lot of people across the world wrote in wanting to keep that. So that was a big interest there for a while, too, saving the Hubble and Pluto anytime something like that makes the news. Yeah, I really had a question about linear amplifiers, Dick. Probably a very simple question. I see a lot of amplifiers. Let me drop it.
Go right ahead with your question. I'm sorry I misunderstood. You got it there, Paul.
Oh, okay, very good. This has to do with linear amplifiers, you know, for HF. I see there's quite a few of them, a few amplifiers that When advertised, they'll say, okay, run on 110, 220, 240, you know, either or. I'm wondering if there's an advantage if you plug it into a 110, you're going to get 1500 watts out, say, on one of, what I'm looking at is RF concepts. Just, you know, using that as an example because that was advertised in QST this month. You know, the Alpha 9500 linear. And they advertise 110, 220, 240. Is there any advantage? I mean, would it pay for somebody to actually run a 220 line to their shack if they didn't have it? You know, is the amp going to run cooler? You're going to save power, you know, less kilowatt hours or something? I'm trying to... Or is it just convenience? It'll run on everything, and you know whatever you have set up will plug into it. Back to you, Dick.
If you had an amplifier that's capable of 1,500 watts output key down, and you're doing that alignment into a dummy load so that you're sure it's got 1,500 watts peak envelope power when you're running single sideband, you're only allowed to run 1,000 watts output in Morse code mode, but in sideband mode, you're allowed to run 1,500 watts peak envelope power. That amplifier, key down 1,500 watts output into the dummy load, is going to draw something damn close to 15 amperes on the 110-volt line. As such, you're very close to blowing the fuse for the shack because you've probably got a number of other things in the shack running. So there's about three advantages I can think of running the amplifier on 240, let's call it. Number one, one-half the current. Number two, one-quarter the equivalent line drop. When you take an amplifier that's drawing close to 15 amperes from the 110-volt line, if you're running it on 110, 115, you're going to get some number of volts of drop when you go key down. And if you're running it on 240 instead of 115, you're going to get, because of a smaller amount of current drawn, less voltage drop. And because you're starting off with a higher voltage to begin with, it's a smaller percentage of drop. You cannot 4-to-1 ahead. So if you really care about not blowing fuses and getting maximum power output and maximum performance out of your rig without dimming the lights in the shack, there's a lot of advantage in running on 230 volts, 240 volts. The amplifier itself, if everything else, if the power, the 110 volt or 230 volt power that you deliver to the amplifier is going into the exact same transformer, which has got, let me drop, it's got two different primary windings, one made for 115 and one made for 230. Once you deliver the primary power correctly to the transformer, the rest of your amplifier doesn't know the difference, assuming the fan is properly wired for that voltage and so on. The rest of the amplifier doesn't know, because the secondary voltage coming out of that transformer, in theory, is the same. So it's a little bit less convenient to rewire the shack and make sure you've got a 230-volt circuit. But if you want maximum performance as far as line drop is concerned and not run into occasionally blowing the fuse or the circuit breaker, I see a significant advantage of going 230. If the amplifier's got it, and if you've got the time to wire it, go for it, in my opinion, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2KEY would have comment on this.
Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, I have separate lines to the shack, 220 lines, 110 lines, everything, you name it, it's all, this whole shack is properly wired for whatever I need up there. I had an amplifier when I first got it. It was wired for 110 volts. And I figured, I'll try it out, you know, kilowatt amp. I'll put it on there and see how it works out. Well, at the kilowatt, when I pushed it to its full power, you're talking to the mic, and you see the lights, the ceiling lights, and the lights in the house were modulating, Dick, over.
And the next half of that story, Mel, is that when you rewired and did everything on that amplifier to 230, my guess is the amount of flicker of the light almost disappeared. Is that true?
Exactly. At that time I was getting, hey, what are you doing now? The lights actually were blinking. I guess it was just the lines that come in from Edison outside, the drop line to the house. I guess, you know, it created a voltage drop on that, right? Because it fed its way all through the house. In fact, I was looking out the window and looking at my neighbor's house, the light in the hall. I think I just actually saw, because that's on the same drop line. You know, they just got a jumper across the space between the houses. They got the one drop line comes from the pole, goes to my neighbor's house first, and actually jumps across then to my house. I think I saw some lighting change in her house over.
So when it comes to flickering of lights, as you can see, Paul, there's a significant advantage of running on 230 if your amplifier will take it. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I'm looking at the 15 amps and the 7.5 amps. You're a lot better off drawing 7.5 amps. But yeah, okay, power comes out to the same. The voltage, you know, you're doubling it, and you're getting half the amperage. Okay, very good. Well, half the amperage going through the unit itself, maybe it's better for the amplifier, too. And I know I wouldn't want any flickering lights. No, that sounds terrible. I could imagine a CW. I wonder if Mel tried it on CW. wonderful lights. I bet the lights are flashing like crazy. Okay, Dick, back to you.
I'm going to ask Mel a question about CW. Mel and I remember the article that we read in QST a zillion years ago about a guy who had flickering light problems with the neighbors complaining. So he made a circuit of relays that when he pressed down the key, the amplifier went on. When he lifted up the key, the relay flipped and turned on 700 watts of light bulbs, if you know what I mean. So the light bulbs were on key up, the light bulbs were off key down, but the amplifier was on. And that made the flickering of the lights for the rest of the neighborhood go away. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Oh, yeah, Roger. In fact, I couldn't even take that amplifier to its full power. It draws a heck of a lot more than 15 amps, Dick. If you could get it up to its full power, that Collins amplifier pulls approximately on the 220 line, it pulls about 22 amps, I think, on the 220 line. You know, they got that's a hefty power supply in there, and a pair of those 3CX 1500, Dick. You know, this is not a staunchy amp, so it's conservatively rated at 1500 watts. So you just can't get away with doing much with it on 110 volts. I don't suggest any amplifier. I think 220 is the way to go when you get into the kilowatt range, over.
Now, you were saying, Paul, that you believe the whole amplifier will run cooler on half the current. Bear in mind now that whether or not you put, let me pick a number, 15 amperes of 115 volts or 7.5 amperes of 230 volts, those are the two combinations into your amplifier. And yes, at the higher voltage is half the current. The only portion of that amplifier that sees the difference in the current is the on-off switch and the primary of the power transformer. You're either using half the winding of the primary or the full winding. But once you deliver the power to that primary circuit of the transformer, everything from there downrange is the same, as long as your house has got stiff enough wiring where the voltage is not being dropped. So there'll be essentially no difference in coolness of amplifier. There will be a lot of difference as to whether or not you're coming close to blowing your circuit breaker or fuse, which you'll run close to that problem on 115, and the dimming light problem in half the house. Half of your house will have dimming lights when you're using only 115 instead of 230. WS2N, K2RIW, tell us anything about space if you want to, Paul.
Okay, that's terrible. Very good. Well, you've got a new crew went up to the space station. I think they just arrived yesterday. So probably up to Exposition 24 or 25, I don't know. They're losing track now. But many, many crews going back and forth. So they're back to a six-person crew. They had three people for a while. Just the other crew came back. About 3 or 4 weeks ago, and now they're back to their standard six people. Originally designed for eight, space station was supposed to have eight. Then they settled off at six, dropped down to seven for a while, and then now down to six. One guy going up, his name is Kelly. He went up there. Let me drop it.
Yeah, I think he's the identical twin, and 6 months later, his other twin is going to be going up, and this is the first time where two members of the same family will be on the space station at the same time. Is that true, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, that's true. They've both flown before, but never at the same time, so that should be pretty good. Yeah, he'll be going up in February. And I think... last time I checked, they didn't extend the shuttle mission beyond February for 2011. So he's going to be the commander for the final mission
far as I know. Still talk about trying to extend it, but I haven't heard anything within the last 3 or 4 weeks. They really should. But from what I see, they're looking to just stop everything. We'll be talking about all the robot missions. They're going to keep going, though. They'll be sending new ones up, so we'll have something to discuss. For now, we're going to have crews replaced only by Russia, and eventually privately here, if it goes the way that one group wants to have it. I think Obama wants private. Let me drop it. The Senate, they want to bring probably the Constellation mission, the whole program back. And Congress, I don't think they can figure out what they want to do. So they had a plan too. I think a little combination of both. So each group has a plan. The only ones that are assured right now are all the telescopic missions that are up and that are going, and the ones that everything that's been on the table is so far has not been canceled. The James Webb is still active. So I'll be glad to see that go up. We'll be talking about the Messenger mission going into orbit around Mercury. That's not too far away. And a lot of solar missions, there's going to have missions to investigate the sun. There's one that's going to go right into the corona of the sun a few years from now. So a lot of good robotic missions coming up. Back to you, WS2N.
Now that there are 6 astronauts and cosmonauts on the International Space Station, in the past there were numbers like 2 and 3, that implies that the consumables are being used up about twice as fast. Does that mean that the Progress ships that are bringing up replaceable supplies are going to be flying twice as often? Do you have a rough approximation of how many tons they bring up and how often? Is it a flight every month and a half or something like that to bring up X number of tons of raw materials? Back to you, Paul, K2RIW and the TechNet.
The Progress missions are usually once every 2 months. And you got to remember, there's as much garbage that's generated as stuff going up. So the one Progress ship that's attached to the space station all that time is nothing but a big garbage disposal. So they take everything and throw it into that. And when the new one comes up, before that one docks, the Progress that's up there undocks and gets burnt up over the Pacific Ocean. So I think it's 6,000 pounds per Progress. But, you have the ATV, automatic transfer vehicles, being sent up by European Space Agency, and that's twice a year, I believe that's scheduled for. And now Japan, they sent one up recently, the HB2, I think they call it. That's a resupply ship as well. I think about 3 times more capability than the Progress. So plenty of supplies. Let me drop it. They're not going to stop up there. They are loaded with stuff and food, water, bags of water. If you go to, you look for the virtual tour on the space station with astronaut Fink, and he gives a tour of this whole station. When it was still a three-person crew before it originally became a 6-person crew about a year and a half ago. And they didn't have the cupola attached and a couple of other parts, but it was pretty much finished. And you go from one cylinder to the next, or one room to the next, and I think there's 10 living compartments up there, or rooms, 10 rooms. It's like a 10-room building, you know, going from one end to the other. There is stuff in computers. There's got to be 50 computers on board that thing. Every time you went to a new compartment, there's laptops all over, attached to the ceiling, the walls. There's bags and bags of, you know, when you go through the, they call them the nodes. That's roughly, a 10 by 10 room. Figure that. That would be a node. And that's only like an interconnecting room from one gigantic section to another. And this is where they load up all these bags of food and water and stuff that they need that they have put away in. I mean, it really is. To squeeze through from one end to the other, you know, they actually have to squeeze through. They just don't float through because there's so much stuck to the walls. They don't know where to go with all this stuff. It's unbelievable.
Of all the consumables that they use, is any of it, to your knowledge, being recycled, or is everything, to your knowledge, being reused only once? Over to you, Paul.
The Destiny Lab, which is the United States lab, our version of it, has a urine recycling system in it. So that's, and then carbon dioxide, they have these, what are they called, generators, oxygen generators, which is what that. I mean, you know, to some extent things are being recycled. But they do bring up oxygen on these progress ships and nitrogen tanks. You got to remember they're running the same atmosphere we have here on Earth. The same proportion of oxygen and nitrogen. And of course, they don't add the other gases, the argon. But I mean, it's the same proportion, 14.7 psi, just like we have here. So you need nitrogen tanks and oxygen tanks. You have tanks, ammonia tanks for the air conditioning. Stuff has to come up there all the time. They have plenty of stuff stored extra, but there's always more stuff coming up. As they use it, they replace their backups. They have backups to backups. Everything's redundancy.
I do remember something like lithium hydroxide filters were used on the Apollo mission to filter out the carbon dioxide given off by human beings. But just filtering it out maybe not is enough for the International Space Station. Is there a technique you know of by which the exhausted carbon dioxide from the human being can be processed in such a way that you remove the carbon and now the oxygen is ready to be used again, as opposed to just a filtering out carbon dioxide and throwing it away and locked up in a filter? Over to you, Paul.
I know the Russians have these generators, oxygen generators. I think they somehow split the... I think they have a process like that. I really don't know. The chemical breakdown of how that all works. But, Russian system is different than ours. And we weren't crazy about the Russians because, it's an ignition system in there. In fact, they call them candles. And that's one of the things that's the thing that got on fire that time in the Mir space station, Russian space station. And they had a big problem with the fire in there. I'm not sure how to, chemically how it works.
I think you said there are 6 astronauts and cosmonauts on the International Space Station right now. And each of the, I think it's Soyuz crafts, can take down 2 astronauts at a time. If a massive evacuation was required, how do you remove 6 astronauts in a hurry? Paul, go ahead.
Now, each one is three. There's three seats available on every Soyuz craft. In a launch flight, a proton rocket, each Soyuz craft has three. So there's no problem there. So you have right now two Soyuz craft docked to the Pyrrhus docking collar. That's the Russian docking collar. They have two of them. And then there's another one, which, I mean, it looks like a Soyuz craft, and that's the Progress craft. That's docked to another one. So if you were to fly up there and look, you would say, oh, it looks like three Russian craft attached. Yeah, two are Soyuz craft, and one's a Progress craft. And the Progress craft is the one they're using as a garbage disposal unit.
You did say for a short period of time there were seven astronauts on board. Was that only during the time that a shuttle was attached? Go ahead.
I think the most they had was 13 at one time. Let's see, 7 and 7. I think they had 13 at one time on board. But yeah, that would be with a shuttle attached. No, originally designed for 8. Now they call it Space Station Freedom. I remember Reagan giving it that name, but it never went that way. It was designed for 8. They dropped it down to 7. When they had 7, it was going to be a lifeboat that we had built, Boeing or Lockheed or one of those people. They built this thing, spent billions of dollars, tested it and everything, and never really brought it up to space. It looks like a small space shuttle. It was called the X-38, and it was going to be space station. It was going to be brought up in cargo bay for station. And there were 7 people on board, and it had no windows. So, but it was designed to come down and fly through the atmosphere just like a shuttle and land on skis. It didn't have wheels, it had skis. And it had this big parasail that would float down before it landed. So that's when they planned on 7, but that never happened. So then they dropped it down to 6.
Question, WHCDM.
Andy recognized, but all of a sudden I've got a question. In the very beginning, if you watched The Right Stuff, that early movie, in the very beginning, the Mercury space capsule and maybe the Gemini space capsule was not going to have a window. The astronaut was going to be a captive, a mouse on board, so to speak, and just looking at a display screen. And the astronaut screamed and hollered, "You will give these pilots a window." So this recovery craft that you just mentioned, I don't think any astronaut would get on board that thing would agree to get on that board if he had nothing but a display screen to look at. If he doesn't have a window to look out of, can you imagine Apollo 13 when you had no power, so to speak, what it would be like if you didn't have a window? Over to you for a quick comment on that one, Paul.
No windows. Carbon all over it. This is a lifeboat, you know. The space station's burning up and we're going. And you wouldn't care if you had a window or not at that point. So Mercury flights, look at all the monkeys. They went up. They didn't need windows, so they didn't have a window. But when it came to launch Shepard, they had a window. I guess Andy had a question. Back to you there. WS1.
Very fine. You got it, Andy. Yes, Andy. Wait for the beep.
Okay, hello, Dick and Paul. How you doing? I got to make it really quick because I'm just pulling into the driveway. What kind of psychological tests do these astronauts go through? Because I would imagine them being up there for the given time that they're up there, and I don't know how many months, being in that confined space, even though the space shuttle is quite large. What is it, the size of a football field at least? You might tell me. But given the size of it, when they come back down to Earth and they have freedom again, what kind of a psychological effect does it have on these people that do this? And how do they know that once they go up there, they're not going to panic and they're going to say, "Uh-oh, I don't like this. This is not good. get me down. And they can't do that. How do they go through that? Go ahead, Dick. I'll give it back to you, but I got to make it quick.
I am guessing there's an awful lot of psychological screening that goes into the selection of an astronaut. And there was a panic in space that occurred on a Soviet craft. But I'll go into that a little bit later. Paul, you probably got some comments on this. WS2N, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Yeah, I think you're talking about the Salyut 7 mission, but or the earlier Soviet space station. I know they had a problem. Size, yeah. Looking at it, the size of a football field. That's easy. That's your light ending. But, you know, think of the rooms. Figure 10 rooms. Take a room in your house. You know, maybe that might be, say, 20 feet long, one of the bigger rooms, and make it about 14 feet wide. And take about 10 of those, well, let's see, if it's 20 feet, yeah, an average of 10 of those types of rooms. Line them all up end to end and put a big round door, you know, with a big 1 meter round door between each one. And that would give you an idea of how long this is, you know, how much room they have going from room to room. That's the best way to put it. A 20-foot long room and take about 10 of them together. You know, I mean, some are longer than that and some are shorter than that, but we'll take that as an average. Back to you, Dick.
In the case of a submarine or a large ship, you've got all kinds of bulkheads and bulkhead doors you can close off if you get a leak somewhere. How many doors can be closed between the various modules if you suddenly get an air leak? And life would get very complicated if that occurred. If the whole damn ship, and that's a really big volume you're describing, is all running at 14.7 pounds per square inch, and if you suddenly get a leak in one of those modules, does every one of them have doors that can be closed? I know for a period of time they had a bunch of temporary cables going through one of those doors.
Did you pass the screen deck?
For some crazy reason, my rig decided to turn off its PL tone. So I remember for a while there was a bunch of cables going through one of the doors as a temporary fixture. I guess that was on the Soviet space station. So can these doors be closed off if you get a leak between a certain module? Over to you, Paul.
Oh, yeah, everything has doors. And, on the Mir space station, when they had that, they had a crash. The Progress spacecraft crashed into the Mir space station, and it hit one of the components, or one of the rooms, I like to call. I think it was, the Kavant room. So they had a big leak there. They closed that door off, you know, completely isolated it from the rest of the space station. Never opened it again, ever. So, I mean, they made, you know, future missions, but they never used that one. I always thought they were going to send up a replacement, disconnect that one, and put another one up. But, ran a few more years after that, and then they deorbited the whole space station. But, yeah, you know, you go from one end to the other. You've got the Russian service module, the Vesta, the drop. The door between that and they call it the FGB, the functioning cargo block, the Zarya, that's the Zarya unit, that's another Russian part. That was the first part that was ever set up, by the way. And between that and you've got the this adapter, there's a door on the Zarya, there's a door. And then there's a door leaving this adapter, and the adapter then connects to node. They call these nodes, and nodes are nothing but one big room. I think it's about 14 feet long, but all kinds of these, you know, the equivalent of six doors to it, you know,